money from individuals who donate to the school, to which, honestly, some of the folks who are running the school and running the university say, okay, that's fine. We're doing what it is we want to do, and we believe that we'll, continue to find the money to do that. But we're not interested in changing direction because these people who fund our work don't like how we're managing things.
Students toppled the statue, the Confederate statue, in 2018. Now the UNC press is in the crosshairs of the Board of Governors, which is refusing to reappoint Professor Eric Mueller, who criticized the handling of the Silent STEM statue. We have 5 seconds.
Yeah, Eric Mueller is a renowned UNC law professor who has been on the UNC press board for 2 terms. He was
3 seconds.
Expected to be reappointed, was not reappointed, and has butted heads with the Board of Governors.
We'll leave it there. Joe Killian, thanks for joining us.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Like the KBOO Community Radio Facebook page. Find KBOO Community Radio on Facebook and like our page, and have events, ticket giveaways, and great information delivered directly to your personal feed. 1 out of every 7 humans is on Facebook, so using Facebook to share KBOO with your friends and family has never been easier. Like KBOO on Facebook today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, expelled State Representative Mike Nierman will not retake his seat. Oregon OSHA issues temporary rules to protect workers from extreme heat. And in international news, Haiti's president was assassinated early this morning. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 7th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The State House seat of former Representative Mike Nierman has been filled by his former aide, Anna Scharf. Nierman was expelled in June for facilitating far-right rioters' entry into the state capitol building in December. In early June, video evidence showed Nierman meeting with supporters and implying that they could text a phone number that might be his and someone would come to open a door for them. He was the first representative in the history of Oregon State to be expelled from the legislative body. Since his seat opened up, county commissioners in the area District 23 covers had to appoint a new person to fill out his term. Surprisingly, the expelled Mike Nierman entered into the appointment pool as well. County commissioners rejected Nierman, however, and appointed one of his former aides, Anna Scharf, instead. After 107 heat-related deaths in Oregon, Governor Kate Brown is directing state OSHA officials to enact temporary rules to protect workers from future extreme heat events. The new rules will expand requirements for employers to provide shade, rest, and cool water for workers during high temperatures. Governor Brown said, quote, "All Oregonians should be able to go to work knowing that conditions will be safe and that they will return home to their families at the end of the day," end quote. The majority of heat-related deaths counted so far involved people who did not have access to air conditioning or fans, many of whom were alone in their own residences. The state is also working to remind Oregonians that Medicaid members may be eligible to receive air conditioners if they have a qualifying underlying condition. Permanent rules are expected to be adopted in the fall. The president of Haiti was assassinated in the early hours of Wednesday morning. President Jovenel Moïse was killed by unidentified gunmen while sleeping in bed with his wife. The gunman spoke English and Spanish, according to reports, and appeared to be foreign since most in Haiti speak French or Haitian Creole. Moise faced accusations of attempting to install a dictatorship in the country, since he had stayed in his position as president over a year after the country failed to hold elections. Just this week, Moise appointed Claude Joseph as prime minister, though Joseph has yet to be sworn in. The head of the Supreme Court passed away from COVID recently as well, so Moise's assassination comes amid a power vacuum. The Prime Minister Joseph and the cabinet say they will assume the executive powers until another president can be elected. Leaders around the world have condemned the assassination. The prolonged hot weather and threats of another bad wildfire season this year could underscore the way that climate change is affecting the Pacific Northwest. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
An unprecedented heat wave and fears of another severe wildfire season have put the warming climate at center stage in the Northwest. Heat has broken records across the region and claimed hundreds of lives on the West Coast, and temperatures have remained high in Idaho since last week. Alicia Bean, climate campaign coordinator for the Idaho Conservation League, says these conditions get at the health aspects of the changing climate.
How are these people going to adapt to this long-term, you know, more than 1 or 2 days sustained heat, given the resources and the infrastructure that they have? We are not prepared to handle something like that.
Bean thinks the nation needs to take two approaches to climate change. It must do what it can to mitigate the effects by reducing greenhouse gas emissions and also learn to adapt to the new, warmer climate. 60% of Idaho faces severe drought this year, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and nearly all the state faces moderate drought. Bean says the long-term trends of drier fuels, higher air temperatures, and lower snowpacks are increasing the length and intensity of wildfire seasons.
All of those different observed impacts from climate change coupled together enable future wildfires that are going to be larger, more intense.
She notes not all fire is bad, and that it can be used in controlled ways to help the forest. But nearly all the current fires burning in Idaho were started by people. Jonathan Oppenheimer, also with the Idaho Conservation League, sees these conditions as a preview of what's to come.
It really emphasizes the need for us as Idahoans and Westerners across this portion of the country to really work to reduce climate impact, to do what we can to transition to renewables, to use public transportation, and to take the personal steps that we can all take to reduce some of our climate impact.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Senator Mitch McConnell is promising a fight in the reconciliation process for Biden's infrastructure plan. With more on that story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is going to be a hell of a fight over what this country ought to look like in the future. And it's all going to unfold here in the next few weeks.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell vows to battle Democrats over plans to use reconciliation to pass an infrastructure package, a process that allows bills to pass with a simple majority instead of 60 votes. The White House and a bipartisan group of senators are promoting a $1.2 trillion deal, but Democratic leaders want a much bigger reconciliation package to appease progressives. Speaking in his home state of Kentucky, McConnell called the reconciliation bill a non-starter.
I don't think we've had a bigger difference of opinion between the two parties over the best thing to do for America than we have right now.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York used a visit to Lake Ontario Tuesday to demand the northern U.S. border with Canada be reopened to those vaccinated.
Now that the vaccine is proven to be safe and reliable, and over 70% of New Yorkers have gotten the vaccine, it makes no sense. And now the percentage of Canadians, which used to be in the low numbers, is now going up. And not, we're not saying everybody should cross. We're just saying the people who have the vaccine.
The Democrat blamed Canada for a failure of the two countries to reach an agreement on reopening and defining, quote, essential travel, unquote. Schumer argued the shutdown hurts businesses during the peak summer tourist season. The White House unveiled new steps to increase access to the COVID-19 vaccine, including door-to-door outreach, expanded mobile clinics, and vaccination sites for workers. One-third of the eligible population has not been vaccinated. COVID cases are currently up in half of U.S. states, including Mississippi, where the fully vaccinated rate is the lowest in the nation. Congressman Benny Thompson criticizes the governor there for failing to take federal money to identify vulnerable areas.
I have 4 counties in my district out of 26 where we didn't have a single vaccination site. FEMA would have paid 100% of the cost of those sites.
After more than two decades, the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan is coming closer to an end.
It's time now for us to complete this mission and for the Afghan forces to defend their own people and their sovereignty.
Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby says more than 90% of the withdrawal process is complete, ahead of President Biden's September 11th deadline. The commander of U.S. troops in Afghanistan warns the Taliban is increasing its presence, which could send the country into chaos. But Kirby explains the Pentagon is focusing on ensuring a safe and orderly drawdown.
As for if the Taliban take over, that's a big if. That's a hypothetical. And I don't think it's helpful for anybody right now to engage in hypothesizing about, you know, what might happen in months and years from now.
The Afghan government and the Taliban have been in peace talks since last fall, with hopes for a negotiated resolution before September. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The uncle of the young woman who recorded George Floyd's murder was killed in a car crash by Minneapolis police. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
The uncle of the teen who recorded George Floyd's murder was killed in a vehicle crash involving Minneapolis police. Tarnella Frazier video recorded George Floyd's May 2020 death on her cell phone. The video went viral and elicited worldwide protests calling for police reform and racial justice. Prosecutors used the recording to convict former police officer Derek Chauvin of second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. He was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison. Minneapolis police were pursuing a fleeing carjacked vehicle on Tuesday when they collided with another automobile. The driver of that car, Darnella Frazier's uncle, Lanail Lamont Frazier, and the police officer went to the hospital. Lanail Frazier died shortly thereafter from multiple blunt force injuries, per the medical examiner. The officer sustained serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Darnella Frazier posted on Facebook that Minneapolis police killed her uncle and that another black man had lost his life in the hands of the police. Pulitzer Prizes awarded her a special citation in 2021, labeling her recording of George Floyd's murder as courageous. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the importance of safe medication disposal. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 58 degrees. Tomorrow we'll see sunny skies and a high of 82. Today in history, in 1928, the first loaf of sliced bread was sold in Missouri by its inventor. It was first advertised as, quote, the greatest forward step in the baking industry since bread was wrapped. The quote of the day is from British author and creator of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, who died on this day in 1930. Doyle wrote in the Boscombe Valley Mystery, quote, "There is nothing more deceptive than an obvious fact." Eric Adams won the Democratic nomination for New York mayor. Adams is the Brooklyn Borough president and former police captain. Catherine Garcia, the city's former sanitation chief, came in second by one percentage point and has conceded the race. Adams' win in the primary puts him in a strong position to win the mayoral race overall, since registered Democrats outnumber Republicans in New York City by 6-1. If elected, Adams will become New York City's second black mayor. New York has never had a woman mayor. The primary election used ranked choice voting for the first time, and it took 2 weeks to tabulate all the votes since there were 13 candidates. Voters in the primary could rank their preferred candidates, and if their top candidate didn't get enough votes, their next choice would receive their vote. Adams centered his campaign on improving public safety, promising to strike a balance between addressing rising crime rates and eliminating racial bias from the police department. Former President Donald Trump is suing Facebook, Twitter, and Google and their chief executives, alleging illegal censorship. This is a class action suit. so it allows others who've been banned or had messages removed from these online services to be included. Trump said this in a morning news conference, quote, "This is the first of numerous other lawsuits I assumed that would follow." He continued, quote, "It will be a pivotal battle in the defense of the First Amendment." Internet companies are generally allowed to moderate their content by removing posts that, for instance, are obscene, incite violence, or violate the service's own standards under a part of the Communications Decency Act called Section 230. Matt Schurz is the president of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Schurz said of the action, quote, "Frivolous class action litigation will not change the fact that users, even U.S. presidents, have to abide by the rules they agreed to." For years, volunteers in western South Dakota have worked to delve into the history of a Native American boarding school. The effort has led to a pending land swap that aims to mend fences with the tribal community, and it's moving forward under the growing shadow of burial sites located at these schools. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Work continues on a boarding school project in Rapid City, South Dakota, as discoveries are made of burial sites at former residential schools in Canada. Mike Moen reports.
Almost a decade ago, a volunteer-driven effort was launched to verify details about Native children buried at a former federal boarding school on Rapid City's west side. That research paved the way for an historic agreement with the city to establish parcels of land for Native purposes. Project volunteer Valeria Big Eagle says news out of Canada and the remains of 215 children found there adds an emotional element to the local effort.
We've heard these horror stories of children that were, you know, killed and buried, and we've heard this from our elders, and it's really, really challenging.
New details about the land transfer will be shared at a public meeting this Thursday, including converting some of the property into a Native American community center. That follows a resolution approved by the City Council last fall, acknowledging that tribes were never given a portion of the land long after the school closed. Fellow project volunteer Eric Zimmer notes the non-Native population can share in this experience as well.
What we're talking about doing is undertaking work that sort of raises the quality of life for everyone in the community through a long, careful, deliberate process of trying to understand and respond to the more challenging parts of our history.
And volunteers were recently recognized for their work with an honorable mention in the Outstanding Public History Project Award, issued annually by the National Council on Public History.
That was Mike Moen. Canada has a new Governor General, the Inuk leader Mary Simon. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, she's making history as the first Indigenous person to take on the role of the Queen's representative in Canada.
Simon began her introductory remarks in Inuktitut. She went on to thank both Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Queen Elizabeth for their confidence in what she described as a very historic opportunity.
This is a moment that I hope all Canadians feel part of, because my appointment reflects our collective progress towards building a more inclusive, just an equitable society.
Simon also becomes Canada's 30th Governor General. The Queen approved the appointment on Trudeau's recommendation.
Canada is a place defined by people who serve those around them, who tackle big challenges with hope and determination, and above all, who never stop working to build a brighter tomorrow. In other words, people like Mary Simon.
Simon is from Nunavik in northern Quebec. She has long been an advocate for Inuit rights and culture. She has also worked with the federal government on several issues, including NAFTA, the repatriation of the Constitution, and the implementation of Canada's first land claims policy. She has also represented Canada as Ambassador of Circumpolar Affairs and as Ambassador to Denmark. Simon's appointment comes as the country struggles with reconciliation and as more unmarked graves are discovered across the country on the grounds of former residential schools. It's not clear yet when she will take up her new post. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Postal Service and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute are holding a release ceremony for the Raven Story Stamp on July 30th in Juneau, Alaska. It was designed by Tlingit artist Rico Worrell. The ceremony is public and will be live-streamed. The stamp is now available for pre-sale. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Historically, students of color have been less likely to receive post-secondary degrees than their white counterparts. A new legislative task force in Oregon wants to change that. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Oregon lawmakers want to ensure more underrepresented students are successful in higher education. At the end of the 2021 session, a bill was passed to create a task force to find out how to accomplish this goal. The Senate President and House Speaker will appoint members to the task force for later this summer. Representative Teresa Alonzo Leon, a Democrat from Woodburn, was one of House Bill 2590's chief sponsors. She wants to reimagine higher education.
We're going to travel around the state and talk to all of our students and hear about what's working, what we can do better, how can we improve things. I just have a vision for really transforming our post-secondary institutions through the lens of our students.
Alonzo Leon has a history working for colleges and was the first Latina GED administrator for the state. The task force will work with students of color and those from rural communities, LGBTQ students, and other groups traditionally underrepresented in colleges and universities. Ben Cannon heads the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which will assist with the task force's work. He says affordability and complex applications can be barriers for people applying for college, especially if they're first-generation students. He says it's important to work both with individual schools and at the statewide level to make post-secondary education attainable for all.
The institution by institution work to identify the particular things they can do to better support these students and the type of systemic look that a legislative task force will likely take to these issues.
Alonzo Leon says college campuses should foster a sense of belonging. That can be hard for some students of color when schools don't have a dedicated space for diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Not all campuses have a DEI office or a multicultural center, and those are things that are really important to students. They need to connect. They need to find ways to connect with other students and other like-minded students, whether it's their culture or an area of interest.
The task force is slated to work through December of 2023. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Superior National Forest in Minnesota could serve as a refuge for wildlife as the climate warms. Dr. Anthony Lazowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In northeastern Minnesota, moose, lynx, and wolves roam the vast wilderness of Superior National Forest. Bass and trout splash in lakes and streams. It's a large region with rich and diverse habitats that provide homes for many plants and animals. So as the climate warms and species geographic ranges shift,
places like the Northwoods of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, where we do have a lot of intact forests, a lot of good natural communities, are going to be really critical to allow nature to adapt to changing climate.
That's Michael Pressman of the Nature Conservancy. The organization has identified undeveloped, interconnected lands across the country, and it's prioritizing its conservation efforts in these areas. The Nature Conservancy recently bought more than 2,000 acres of private land in Superior National Forest. The purchase will help prevent future development in critical habitat.
Nature is moving in response to a changing climate, and nature doesn't move well when it's fragmented, when there are lots of roads, lots of buildings, lots of parking lots.
So making sure that large areas of undeveloped land remain intact can help provide refuge for wildlife, now and in the future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A new study in Wisconsin shows that population loss for wolves may be even greater than expected since federal protections for the animal were lifted. Wolves are an important part of habitat restoration, and activists are encouraging officials to make kill quotas as conservative as possible. Mike Mullen has the story.
Another Wisconsin wolf hunt is on the horizon, with DNR officials trying to balance concerns from wildlife protection groups and those who support the hunts. But a new population study adds a layer of skepticism about the sustainability of these wolf hunts. University of Wisconsin researchers say nearly 100 additional gray wolves died around the state after the animal was removed from the Federal Endangered Species Act last winter. That's on top of the 218 wolves killed by licensed hunters during Wisconsin's late-season hunt. Sarah Bergstrom with the group Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf and Wildlife says it isn't surprising.
I think that a lot of us had that same gut feeling that that was probably the case, but it's nice to see kind of the numbers and modeling to go with it.
The study says it's likely most of the additional wolf deaths were the result of illegal hunting activity by poachers. The legal kills took place in a brief February hunt prompted by a lawsuit after the delisting, when hunters far exceeded the established quota. The DNR says it's using science to determine a quota for this fall's event, but researchers estimate all the recent deaths have dropped the state's wolf population by one-third. The study's authors say a pause in hunting activity over the next couple of years could allow the population to rebound, and Bergstrom feels it's impossible to move forward with the hunt this year. She says it would interfere with the longer-term evaluation of the hunts and their impact on the wolf population.
There's no way of saying that the fall hunt will be any better or more reasonable than the February hunt was without some concrete guidance as to how that's going to happen.
However, Wisconsin law requires an annual hunting period when wolves are not under federal protection. Supporters of these hunts say wolves prey on livestock, and they insist fears about decimating the wolf population are overstated. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants a day without changes.
Tumbling dominoes, not just beachfront condos, Key West streets underwater, a fire in the Gulf of Mexico, mudslide in Japan, the hottest place on Earth burns 2 days later in North America's hottest June ever. After 20 years in Afghanistan, U.S. troops sneak out in the middle of the night. 75% of Oregonians vaccinated, 35% in Alabama and Idaho, 1% of Africa. COVID keeps evolving. We demand things get back to normal. The economy is surging. Help wanted signs everywhere. As if suddenly we can afford restaurants, festivals, gasoline prices up 50% in a year. At least we can count on Trump continuing to spur on his well-armed delusional supporters, and you never know when it will be January 6th again. Enjoy this warm day, the ripe fruit, the beautiful people. Who knows what next week could bring? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 7th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, and Yasmin Kobanoglu. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Mike Moen, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be talking about safe medication disposal.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu, and this is KBOO News In Depth. People in Oregon will now have a convenient way to get rid of unwanted medication, either by disposing of them in person at drop-off sites or by mailing them in through prepaid, pre-addressed envelopes. The new free statewide program and public education campaign was just announced to help Oregon residents dispose of medicine safely and conveniently. The project will operate over 200 locations across Oregon where residents can drop off expired or unwanted medication. The program is being implemented by Med Project and the Drug Takeback Solutions Foundation. It is supported by the Pharmaceutical Product Stewardship Workgroup, a nonprofit trade association of pharmaceutical companies. The program provides free disposal options statewide to ensure residents have equitable access. These include neighborhood pharmacies, medical facilities, law enforcement offices, and other community-based organizations. Residents who prefer to mail back their expired or unwanted medicine can request a prepaid mailback package or locate a mailback package distribution site, such as a local pharmacy. The program is funded by drug manufacturers and is free of charge to Oregon residents. Those interested in the program can find more information by visiting medtakeback.oregon.org, the DEQ website at oregon.gov/DEQ, or call 1-844-482-5322 toll-free to find a convenient location to drop off medication. Med Project's website includes free downloadable materials with information about the disposal program and guidance on taking medication as directed and storing it securely. KABU spoke with Michael Lee, DEQ Materials Management Program Operations and Policy Analyst, to discuss the Drug Takeback Program.
First off, can you tell our listeners a little about who you are?
My name is Michael Lee. I'm a product stewardship specialist at DEQ with the Materials Management Program.
And what exactly is Med Project?
So Med Project is one of the two program operators that are implementing the Drug Takeback Program, which DEQ oversees.
Can you tell our listeners what this new Drug Takeback Program does?
So, you know, basically, a new statewide option for people in Oregon to throw away their unwanted prescription or over-the-counter medicines. You know, the options include going into drop-off sites such as pharmacies or local law enforcement agencies, or they can dispose of the drugs in person, or they can order prepaid, pre-addressed envelopes and just put the unwanted drugs in an envelope and mail it in. So the service is free. There's no charge to use it, and it's funded by manufacturers, and it's implemented by program operators, you know, one of them being Med Project.
Do you know what the other program operator is?
Yes, it's called the Drug Takeback Solutions Foundation.
And why is safe drug disposal so important?
So, you know, there are a couple reasons, and they both relate to human health and the environment. So, you know, when you leave unwanted drugs in the medicine cabinet, you know, I'm sure a lot of people know that there's always a potential for abuse, addiction, or accidental poisoning. If they're flushed down the toilet or thrown in, even in landfills, there's always the danger that it could get into our groundwater rivers.
And who's able to participate in the program?
So the service is available for Oregon residents. It's also available for non-business entities, and also the statute sort of talks about ultimate users, which is more of a technical term, but I think it's basically means someone that has a controlled substance for his or her own use or the use of a household member. But I think broadly it's, you know, for residents of Oregon, and it's meant to basically be a system that complies with, you know, all federal and state laws, so it's both safe and secure.
You mentioned drop boxes and then also the ability to mail in the drugs. How would people go about receiving those packages?
Yeah, so they can go to the program website, and then they can order an envelope online, or they can do it through a toll-free telephone number. We have that information on our DEQ webpage.
Could you explain a little bit about what product stewardship is?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is actually, I think, the third product stewardship program that DEQ, you know, oversees. So product stewardship is an environmental management strategy where, producers and, consumers alike share responsibility for the cost of a product. In the case of the product stewardship programs we have in Oregon, they share the cost of dealing with the disposal of products at the end of their useful life. With the drug take-back program, we have drug manufacturers that are covering the cost of this system of collecting the drugs and ensuring that they're properly destroyed. DEQ also oversees two other programs. One is for paint, and one is for personal electronics. And, both of them involve manufacturers sort of participating in a system to make sure there's collection available for their products after the products are no longer useful.
And can you maybe say a little bit about why that's beneficial?
I think the benefit is that I think traditionally when you think about it, when it comes to waste, it's typically the citizens and the local governments or, the government that have to sort of cover the cost of disposal. This sort of shares the cost more and maybe it's a little bit more equitable to get producers involved. I think it also is an opportunity to get producers to, I think they are in a good position to sort of contribute to the system and design the system because, they understand their products probably better than a lot of other people. And so, they can think of ways to develop a convenient and good system. I think it might also affect how they design their products in the future, especially if you're looking at, certain products like electronics where, there's a focus on recyclability.
And going back to the drug take-back, can you tell us a little bit about the drug take-back law that was passed in 2019?
Yeah, so the drug take-back law was passed in 2019. It basically required drug manufacturers to join and participate in a drug take-back program. Some of the key elements was that drug manufacturers have to cover the cost of the program, so Oregon residents won't be charged for their use. And the program has to be convenient in every county in Oregon. So, it does set a certain number of drop-off sites that have to be established. Those are like pharmacies or law enforcement agencies. If program operators, for whatever reason, can't establish the required numbers, they have to propose additional services. So, and that could look like having public libraries that have envelopes where you can pick up the envelopes in person for mailing back unwanted drugs. I think the emphasis that's on is a system that's supposed to be convenient, safe, and secure, and supposed to be compliant with all federal and state laws. Gives DEQ, oversight authority to make sure that programs are operated in compliance with those laws. And we also partner with the Board of Pharmacy on that responsibility.
And are there other states that are enacting similar programs?
There are. Oregon's one of a handful of states that are doing product stewardship and drug take-back programs in particular. Washington launched their program about a year before us. And I believe California is going to launch their program soon after us. My understanding is they're currently reviewing plans for drug take-back and the Sharks program.
How can our listeners find out more about the program?
Yeah, listeners can visit the DEQ website. We'll have information up there, so if you have the link. And, there's also the program website, which is medtakebackoregon.org. Our website also has the contact information for both program operators. If there are specific questions that people have, they can email them that way. And that's not just for, people that use the program, but also pharmacies and local law enforcement agencies that might be interested in participating as a sort of a host site that could collect drugs, or local governments that want to pass on the news.
That was Michael Lee, DEQ Materials Management Program Operations and Policy Analyst, discussing the state's new drug take-back program. The free statewide program and public education campaign was just announced to help Oregon residents dispose of medication safely and conveniently. The project will operate over 200 locations across Oregon where residents can drop off expired or unwanted medication. The program is being implemented by Med Project and the Drug Takeback Solutions Foundation and is supported by the Pharmaceutical Product Stewardship Workgroup, a nonprofit trade association of pharmaceutical companies. The program provides free disposal options statewide to ensure residents have equitable access. These include neighborhood pharmacies, medical facilities, law enforcement offices, and other community-based organizations. Residents who prefer to mail back their expired or unwanted medicine can request a prepaid mailback package or locate a mailback package distribution site, such as a local pharmacy. The program is funded by drug manufacturers and free of charge to Oregon residents. Those interested in the program can find more information by visiting the DEQ website at oregon.gov/DEQ, medtakebackoregon.org, or call 1-844-482-5322 toll-free to find a convenient location to drop off medication. MedProject's website includes free downloadable materials with information about the disposal program and guidance on taking medication as directed and storing it securely. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu, and this is KBOO News In Depth. Coming up next is news from the Boo.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
African Union finds itself unable to secure second vaccine doses. In early March, many nations in the African Union began to receive doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine through COVAX. The vaccines the program provided were manufactured by the Serum Institute of India, which halted exports in late March when India began to see a major outbreak. The manufacturer said that they will not export through the rest of the year. Now that there are about 20 million Africans with only one AstraZeneca dose and without a second one in sight, according to NPR, more than 90% of the second doses were supposed to come from the Serum Institute of India. In fact, the African Union expected most of its doses throughout 2021 to come from that manufacturer. While the COVAX doses were not the only source of the vaccine on the continent, the vaccines were secured through direct deals with manufacturers or negotiated by the African Union, and they may not be available for months to come. People who live in Africa who are waiting on a second dose are likely going to be getting it 12 weeks after the first one. Now, according to NPR, this is especially concerning because the African Union vaccine rollout did not cover a majority of residents in the first place. They were only able to provide enough for 40% of the population, most of whom were elderly or essential workers. And in late May, less than 2% of Africans received the shot. The region's Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is still working to secure a second dose for those who don't have one. They are researching how long they can wait between doses of AstraZeneca. Canada, for example, increased the time between the second doses from 12 to 16 weeks. And if immunity remains high with a lengthened interval, the union will be able to buy more time. The group also hopes to negotiate expedited production with another AstraZeneca manufacturer or to utilize another vaccine for the second dose. The Blackfeet Nation, an indigenous tribe in the U.S., is 98% vaccinated. All right. So at the beginning of the pandemic, sadly, brought sickness and death to First Nations tribes across the country and in Canada, of course, as well, but particularly of the Blackfeet Nation. Their lands are located in Montana, and the nearest hospital being 2 hours away. And unfortunately, ambulances had to be called in frequently. So according to NBC News, about 10,000 people live on the tribe's reservation, and the effects of the coronavirus were significant. Tribal health officials recorded more than 1,390 cases of COVID-19, including nearly 50 deaths. But now the tribe is fighting back against the virus, and they're winning. About 98% of the reservation's eligible population has been fully vaccinated against COVID, compared to about 40% of Montana's total population. Vaccination efforts have been so successful that the tribe has gifted surplus vaccines to fellow Indigenous tribes in Canada and non-tribal Canadians during vaccination drives that brought in hundreds of people each day. The tribe also provided shots at a 2-day mobile vaccination site at a port of entry that connects Montana with Canada. Any travelers and tourists who may be visiting Glacier National Park, they can also get vaccinated too. Now, getting to this point wasn't easy, though, as COVID-19 affected Native American communities at disproportionate rates across the U.S., due in part to longstanding health disparities and the lack of infrastructure and medical access, the Blackfeet Nation heeded the warnings about the virus's spread with stringent lockdowns, remote learning for schools, and social distancing rules and mask requirements. So the tribe's business council took the drastic step of closing its eastern entrance to Glacier National Park for the 2020 tourism season, sacrificing economic revenue in favor of